Hello, I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, a game music podcast. If you're new to the show, feel free to skip to this week's chat with VGM legend Austin Wintory. We discuss that game company, including Flow and Journey, and eventually cover the Banner Saga and even some of Abzu. There should be a timestamp within the description to move past this intro. For old listeners, here's an update on the future of the show. You might remember this conversation with Austin was recorded years ago. I know it's taken a long, long time to come out, and it was supposed to be a part of Season 2, and here we are at something I suppose I'm calling Season 3, but all kinds of things have been going on in this strange little hiatus that has been forced on the Sound Test. I got a job, I've been writing novels, I've been working on all kinds of different music, I've been having to sort out my flat from top to bottom, and all along the way look after Daisy, that little three-legged scamp who's still going, thank God. So I've just been finding it increasingly impossible to keep up with the Sound Test, which is a labour of love, a hobby. Finally, I feel like I've got a good little pocket of time to get old pieces of the Sound Test out there that I never actually got round to. And this is just one of them. Although bits of it, the Banner Saga segment, were released in Season 2 as part of the Banner Saga special, which you can go and check out on my channel or on my Spotify feed or wherever you're listening to this. Most of this conversation is brand new to you guys. It's got big, big chunks about Journey in there. Like, I think a good, like, solid 40 minutes at least about Journey. Lots about Flow, which was one of Austin's very first pieces of work. And only about 5 minutes on Abzu, I'm afraid, but it's better than nothing. And I was really pushing it for time with Austin. So we're going to be going ahead with a slightly different format than we had in the past, like those intense documentaries and things like that. Just took a lot of work at the end of the day, I realised. So going forward, I've decided I'm just going to release the interviews as they were. Now, as a result, there are some kind of remnants of me expecting the interview to get cut up and used in a documentary later down the line. So bear that in mind with the way I phrase some of my questionings. But I think the point still comes across and my questions still come across and are clear enough, so we'll get away with it. And I've still pasted good, appropriate music underneath the entirety of the conversation, so it should still have a very similar, very familiar Sound Test flow. And I really hope that you guys are going to enjoy it. It's one of my favourite conversations that I ever recorded. Austin is, of course, the man. You only have to look at what he's worked on to see that. But just listening to his insight and what he's got to say truly is breathtaking. So I'll shut up now, let us listen to Austin, and just say that there will be more in future. There are plenty more interview guests to come. So thank you, and let's get into it. Hello, is this Austin?
Yes, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. You?
Oh, very good. Can't complain.
Good, good. Thanks very much for agreeing to speak to me today.
It is absolutely my pleasure. I appreciate you reaching out.
So I thought before I'd kick off with any questions, I'd give you a quick rundown of what I'm actually going for today.
That would be great.
Yeah, so I make these basically concentrated audio documentaries that stick on a specific subject. It might be a game or it might be a whole like game series. And today I wanted to concentrate on like your work on Flow, Journey, that game company stuff, and Abzu. And then if we can, fit some stuff in about Banner Saga, and then I'd do two episodes about those.
Great. Wow, yeah. That's sprawling.
Yes, if we can fit it in. I mean, like, honestly, it was difficult trying to choose which games to concentrate on because of how much you've done.
Well, I've certainly been very lucky that
a lot of the projects I've worked on have been so just intrinsically interesting that I kind of, even without being self-aggrandizing, just the games themselves, I feel your pain. In other words, I as a gamer, I'm sometimes shocked about the whole thing just because I love some of these projects so much.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, I would have been delving into Assassin's Creed, but of course, if I was to do that, I wanted to do like a full episode about the whole series, and I haven't been able to get in touch with any other composers yet. So I thought I'd leave that for today.
Yeah, well, I am at your disposal, basically, to kind of do it how you want to do it.
Excellent. Well, I thought we'd go through the that games company stuff first then, and start off with Flow, which I think is actually really interesting out of all of your work. Obviously, you've gone on to work with like so much real instrumentation and the winds and the orchestras, but Flow is like largely synthetic, if I'm not wrong. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that use of synths and just how much of the soundtrack it makes up.
Well, absolutely. Flow... Well, first off, it's worth, I don't know if prefacing is quite the right word, but qualifying perhaps, that Flow was my very first sort of real professional undertaking of any kind. It began as a student project, and then after we put the original Flash game up on Genova Chen's USC student site, Sony approached him and said, "We'd like to sign you to a 3-game deal, and you can do anything you want with the second and third game, but the first we would like to be a kind of remake for PS3 of Flow." And so the whole thing for me was kind of this just absolute whirlwind of unfathomable good luck, which was especially shocking because, as you kind of already hinted at, I come from a pretty classical background. My music education prior to going to college consisted of a little bit of being a kind of typical gigging pianist and playing the occasional party or hotel lobby or restaurant or whatever, or mostly just kind of playing around for my own amusement. And then taking a strong interest in composing and managing to kind of draft my high school orchestra into helping me learn. And so I had, by the time I turned 18, I'd already spent, you know, hundreds of hours conducting my high school orchestra and really learning how to work with live musicians and the psychology of the interplay between those and all of that. And so, when Flow came along, it was Genova who had the idea that this should be very tranquil, very relaxing. Part of the reason for it to be entirely electronic was that it began as a student endeavor where there was no money anyway. I mean, it was very much a student project. I mean, literally, his budget for music was on the order of hundreds of dollars. And it was basically just a stipend as a thank you. And I actually told him to keep it because it didn't seem to make sense to me that students would just kind of shuffle money back and forth amongst each other when no one really had any to begin with. So I just said, you know what, keep the money, take your girlfriend out. I have the equipment I need to do this. I'm not going to have that money's not going to enable me to do something I might not have otherwise been able to do. So let's just not worry about that. And off we go. And so it was very intimidating, a lot of experimentation, trying to figure out how to create, you know, interesting textural electronic music. And on top of that, music which was completely interactive. Genova had this fantasy that the thing would be very granular, where every single sound is interconnected with the music and reactive, so that, you know, every little thing that the player does is not only creating sort of audio feedback, but it's actually changing the sound. It's changing the music so that it's engaging with what the player is trying to do in an even more deep way. And I had never done anything like any of that. And it was just horrifyingly intimidating. But, you know, a few months of taking a crack at it, managed to get my head wrapped around it, discovered a tremendous love for electronic music and sort of textured sound crafting, as opposed to relying on traditional instruments of the orchestra to do all that for you, as it were. And so, yeah, that's kind of a little bit of a broad rundown, but your sort of initial statement that yes, it was, you know, in essence something completely different from what I had done, but after it, it is true, and also before it, you know, it's somewhat of an anomaly. Ironically, I have written a lot of music like that, usually in little bits and pieces as part of a project. I mean, people often think of Journey, for example, as an orchestral score, but the first half of Journey is quite a bit like Flow in many respects. It's very textural, very electronic, and I've done lots of film scores that lean on those techniques as well, but it's certainly not what I'm essentially known for.
Right, and I am quite interested in those electronic little tinges that do show up throughout your video game work, so I will be asking a couple of questions about that as we go through. But then,
sure.
If it was still so new to you and you were still experimenting, then what kind of equipment were you using for Flow? And was there any kind of middleware and things like that involved?
We did have middleware involved in the PlayStation version. Back in those days, it was all in-house proprietary Sony stuff, you know, first-hand, first-party kind of equipment. But the initial Flash version, everything was just programmed directly into the game. It was because there was only three of us. It was Genova, Nick Clark, and myself. And so, I had studied a little bit of programming, but I'm no audio programmer. So I was pretty dependent on Nick and Genova to just find a way to hack it directly into Flash. And we managed to do it. And then we were able to take that and go far deeper with it. I collaborated with Sony's in-house sound team, in particular, a guy named Paul Fox, who was just infinitely helpful in the final stages of working on Flow. But there's a whole great team there. There's a guy, Monty Mudd, who I also later worked extremely deeply with on Journey. But in terms of making the sounds themselves, I wasn't using any outboard gear or hardware synths. I was using all software, and I was using almost exclusively like orchestral libraries and things that I would then just sonically manipulate to the point where they didn't sound like their source material at all. Some of it is more obvious than others. It was all just purely the manipulation of existing samples and things and creating essentially custom instruments from that, which is basically a way of saying I had no idea what the hell I was doing, and that just seemed sensible.
Right, no, that's really interesting though, to hear that it was still your like first kind of experiments of these kinds of things, because it is so dynamic and works so perfectly. And so were you also responsible for the individual sound effects for things like picking things up, or like the dissonance that comes in when you get hit by something, and all the individual creature noises? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the creation of those.
Boy, some old memories. I think the main thing was just I would create, you know, hundreds and hundreds of short little sounds and then stack them and mix and match. And then we would just put things in and try them. I mean, the main fundamental goal was that I wanted the sound to always feel very sort of juicy and compatible with the score, such that they became one thing. So the biggest challenge was, how do I create something that's musically not boring, but yet sound effects can trigger at any moment, and I don't know when that will be, and how do I make it so they aren't periodically clashing with the music? Or if they are, they're doing so conscientiously. That was kind of the big struggle. And it took an enormous amount of trial and error to really felt like, you know, to feel like I had gotten it to a place where that was working. But in terms of the individual sounds, I'd be hard pressed to give you some good anecdotes, because it was like 15 years ago now.
Of course, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I get that a lot on these retrospectives that I do, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, if there's some very specific thing, it might jog a memory, but otherwise, yeah.
I only really had one last question on flow in an attempt to try and get through these as quick as possible and still cover everything. Is I wonder if you could talk about the process of rewriting it from the scratch up for the actual commercial release of it, and how much it actually differed from the experience in game.
The chance to be able to rework it was amazing, mostly because reworking might not be the correct way to phrase it. It was actually essentially taking what we had done and then, you know, quintupling the amount of content, because the original game has sort of these different, the Flash version, I mean, basically has one or two at most sort of creatures, if you want to call our abstract geometry creatures, to play as. But in contrast, the full game was, you know, like a half a dozen, and there were all these different style guide thoughts for us to consider of, you know, the emotional landscape, so that one would be warm and beautiful, and then we would pivot to something, you know, slapstick and silly, and then something innocent and naive, and then something that was like cold and dangerous. And they wanted to really explore the nature of these mechanics and what the game can do, but on a wider range of emotions. So it was a chance to kind of go back to the well. And bear in mind, this was only 6 months later or something like that. You know, we put out the Flash title, and almost immediately Sony reached out and made the offer. But nonetheless, diving into that and expanding it, it was thrilling. I mean, it was a real chance to say, oh, I guess there's more to say here. I guess there's more to do. And of course, it forced me to have to really dig deeper and deeper and deeper into these new techniques that were unusual and novel to me. Just simply because I had way more material I had to manage now. But also the other thing was the fidelity. You know, the Flash version had such extreme limitations on what we were able to do. And now we were able to kind of stretch out a little bit more, and also have, you know, higher quality audio and more assets, so that it can get more granular with the player experience, that kind of thing. One of them became practically the proof of concept to the other, which was never the goal, but that's sort of how it shook out.
Right, I can see that, definitely. And obviously for the next, like, that game company title that you worked on, Journey, bringing in a lot more real instrumentation is kind of more of a step in the direction that you were more comfortable with. But I wondered what was the choice, why the choice of cello as the central instrument? Because, for example, I've been playing bass my whole life. And if you play that on its own, it kind of sounds, it always feels like it needs something else for me. You can't just sit and play a bass. But cello does have that isolated appeal. And was that the kind of thing you were thinking of?
It was purely instinct. It was one of those where Genova and I got together after Flower had come out, and we hadn't seen each other very much in the year and a half or so of the time they were working on it, intermittently. And I had played Flower, you know, during the Game Developers Conference and things like that. You know, I remember playing in Kelly Santiago's hotel room and just thinking, my God, you guys have really outdone yourself, and was just so in awe of that game. And so after it shipped, Genova said, I'd love to get dinner and talk about, actually, the funny thing is, I thought he just wanted to kind of catch up and, you know, hang out, purely a social thing. And 5 minutes into the dinner, he says, so I'd like to tell you about what we're working on next. And I remember feeling kind of caught off guard and thinking, well, crap, I should have brought a notebook or something. Because very quickly he just took this deep dive into talking about Joseph Campbell and universal mythologies and the hero's journey and the kinds of landscapes and settings and the nature of the mechanics and his ambition for sort of deeply empathetic multiplayer. And I was so fast thinking, my God, this is a true meeting. I remember I desperately ran to the hostess station at the front of the restaurant and said, do you have any paper and pen that I can use? And they said, sorry, we don't really have stuff like that. And then I remembered that I happened to witness the waitress printing off the receipt for some table's check. And I said, oh, you know, there's an eject button on those. Can you just give me a long scroll of blank receipt paper? And so all my initial notes on Journey are on this long, like 3 foot, 1 inch wide receipt paper from some random restaurant in Santa Monica. But it was one of those off and running. Immediately, I was extremely inspired. Everything he was saying sounded just so incredible to me. And so so necessary in the sense that, you know, at that point I was in my mid-20s, I'd been a gamer my whole life, and I heard what he was saying, and I had this overwhelming conviction that this was a game that was needed in the world, and at least by me. I didn't know if other people would be interested in it, but I thought, I'm starting to reach this age where I'm kind of less excited about the explosions and the higher fidelity machine gun fire and a lot of the kind of classic offerings of games. Even though, to be fair, my favorite games were always like LucasArts adventure, point-and-click adventures. You know, like Grim Fandango is probably my favorite game ever made. And so I was big into the Sierra, you know, King's Quest, Police Quest, Space Quest, Leisure Suit Larry type games, and then all of the games like The Dig, Full Throttle, Loom, Maniac Mansion, of course, Grim Fandango. That was where my heart lay, even though I also was huge into strategy games, and games like Warcraft 3 and Starcraft were very dear to my heart too, but, you know, I played a little bit of everything. And when I heard this, I felt like I've been waiting my whole life to play this game, and I didn't know it. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that until I heard it described to me, and then I thought, I need that. So I couldn't believe how lucky I was that I was being sort of propositioned to be part of it. And so he said, well, why don't we meet at the office tomorrow and I can give you a little bit more information, and we can just see what the next steps might be. And so I went down to that game company, and he gave me a very quick sort of expansion and said of everything he had presented prior to that, and said, maybe over the next couple of weeks, if you could write a theme, some sort of single piece that helps us at TGC rally around an agreed upon, you know, emotional idea. In other words, create music as essentially a piece of concept art where they can all have this sort of true North Star to say, okay, I'm working on the game and I'm not quite sure if this feels the right way, and then have a piece of music and say, well, does the thing I'm working on feel like that? Because we all agree that that feeling in music is what we're after. That's how Genova likes to work. It's very unusual for game designers where he really likes the music to come first. Because for him, game design is all about the emotional takeaway more than it is the exploration of some novel mechanic or user experience in that way. He's all about what experience would create X emotion. And so if he can latch onto a piece of music that has X emotion, he has a kind of, it gives him a clear runway or a clear target of what the rest of the game ought to feel like. So I said, okay, great. And I went and walked into my car. And by the time I got to my car, I had it, which is very unusual. I tend to be a noodler, you know. I tend to like to tinker and experiment and finesse and throw things away and dig them out of the trash and throw them back in the trash. But this was one of those where I walked to my car and it just sort of sprang to mind. And I left myself a voicemail saying, you know, okay, cello, start, solo, simple, blah, 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 blah. Sang it out and said, you know, repeat, add harp, melody reprises on bass flute. And then cello comes back in an upper range and string orchestra comes flooding in. And I dictated the whole thing out into my phone, and then I rushed to my studio and I made a rough draft. And I had my cellist, Tina, and my flute player, Amy, both meet me at the studio about an hour later and recorded it with them. And then I did the string orchestra and the harp and stuff as, you know, just a temporary placeholder mock-up, and sent it over to them that day. And literally it never changed again, other than later going back and recording the orchestra recording the orchestra and replacing the sampled strings. So that original cello, if you listen to the first track on the album called Masons, that performance was literally done that day in early 2009 and never replaced, and never revised or changed in any way.
Yeah, it's a really, really inspiring game as a player. So it's great to hear that the people on the team were feeling that inspiration as well. Apologies if you could hear my dog barking then.
I didn't, but I love dogs, so no apologies warranted.
She's one of the yappy ones, I'm afraid.
Well, we will accept them.
Indeed, of course. But I'm glad that you brought up Tina and Amy, because one of the things I wanted to ask about was to what level there might actually be collaboration between you and these soloists, like how much they might be making musical suggestions themselves.
I always try to make my writing a platform for musicians' expressiveness, because the tighter you try to control things, the more you tend to kind of strangle their full potential. That said, I am pretty specific. I mean, I'll go in there and it's not just even that all the notes are there, but literally every articulation and bowing and phrasing. I will tend to get very specific if I let myself. But by that same token, I do really like the musicians to feel free, not just to make suggestions, but to potentially even, you know, say things like, well, you know, this melody has this one note in the middle that forces me to kind of awkwardly shift my finger positions. And if I just dropped that note, watch how I can play it. And they play it, and suddenly it's so natural and idiomatic, and it feels like, my God, you know, that only a cellist could have written that melody. It's just so natural, that kind of thing. So I'm always talking to them and saying, you know, let's find ways to make it better. Let's find ways to make it better. And sometimes I get lucky and they play it and they say, you know, it just sounds exactly like what we're aspiring to right out of the gate. And then other times, you know, it's a pretty iterative process. Obviously, part of the determining factor of when it's one versus the other is kind of at least partially related to the technical difficulty of the piece as well. If things are truly virtuosic, like for example, in Assassin's Creed Syndicate, there's tons of music that's just wildly difficult to play. And so on something like that, I tend to leave a little bit more room than normal because I like pushing them. But if I push them to a level of challenge where they're not really performing anymore, they're just desperately trying to get the notes, it stops really being music, and it just sounds like we recorded somebody practicing and not necessarily feeling comfortable about it. And I don't like that, because I don't think the final product is that good, but I also don't like putting these musicians in a position where they feel like, you know, they're not their best self, but that recording of them doesn't represent all that they can do. So yes, bottom line, I do try to leave plenty of room for collaboration and sort of hearing out their thoughts. And sometimes it radically changes the music, and sometimes they basically just affirm that I was on the right track.
And one of the most lively tracks in Journey in those terms, in terms of the players, is like Road of Trials. But I thought we could use that as a jumping off point to talk about its dynamic nature and how the player actually determines different things coming in and the actual mix of the music. I wondered if you could talk about a little bit about how that works in Journey.
Well, so the Road of Trials is the sort of the name I retroactively gave to the music of that whole third level of the game, you know, that third area, kind of sand surfing mania, fourth area of the game. And so yeah, I remember Genova saying, you know, we definitely want to dramatically ratchet up the energy level here, and we also want to kind of dial things back in terms of their somberness, because the immense sort of lonely quality and desolate nature of the gameplay up to that point has a potential to be kind of emotionally fatiguing. And he said, you know, I want this to charm us. And in sort of Joseph Campbell sense, or even just as an allegory to a life lived, this is supposed to be kind of youthful, reckless abandon adolescence where nothing, you just don't have a care in the world. And yet, he also said, don't lose sight of the fact, though, that you are snowboarding, as it were, through a lot of remnants of ruined buildings kind of buried in the sand. And he said, you know, we're never going to kind of go too far into trying to contextualize that for the player and tell them what happened here. But there needs to be a little bit of an undertone of sadness or darkness of some kind to just illustrate that you're not out in nature. This isn't actually a snowboarding thing. You're kind of surfing or snowboarding through ruins, and just add a little poignancy for that. And so the design of it is obviously way faster paced. The player is just traversing a lot more territory than at any other prior point in the game. And so just in a very nuts and bolts sense, we needed a lot more energy in the music. But like everywhere else, it has to wrap very carefully around what the player is doing. So a lot of the ways that we achieve that is through a bunch of interconnected loops, almost like if you imagine a chain, and where the individual links are little sort of circles where, you know, a piece of music will loop until the player crosses some threshold. The thing that's interesting about the Road of Trials sequence is that most of the gameplay areas they don't actually really require loops because it's essentially impossible to indefinitely linger. You can do some tricks to lengthen how long it takes you to get through it, or by other measures, you can sort of speed up how fast you go through. But there's a very definite range. You know, the individual sections might be between 20 and 30 seconds, where it can't possibly be shorter or longer than that. So I was able to write music that pretty damn near perfectly linearly matches the player's progression. And then when they hit the little cooldown areas and brief stops, you know, we account for that in different ways. There's one little Mickey Mousey Easter egg that most people are not aware of, which is that when the level very first begins, there's kind of a ramp you can jump off, and doing that will trigger the orchestra to come flourishing in with some loud trills. No matter what's going on in the music, you'll just get this little sort of musical sound effect on your jump. It's the only place in the game I really do that, because it's a gesture that gets old quick and it wears out its welcome pretty aggressively. But then otherwise, yeah, it's just all about, I would play test the game endlessly in order to try and, you know, really, really understand exactly what the player's experience would be and craft the music, you know, very, very tightly around that, as opposed to just saying, oh, well, here's 5 minutes of fast music and we'll just loop this during this level. You know, that would have been an enormous opportunity missed.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, especially what you say about this ramp at the start, because one of my other questions was how much you might have been thinking about the different play styles that you can apply to that game. Like, personally, when I've played through it four completely different times, like every time was a completely different personality. It was like the first time not quite knowing what was going on, and then the white-robed genius knowing everything that's going on, helping someone, pranking someone. So how much were you thinking about these different approaches?
A ton. I mean, I played the game a lot in order to try to really understand all the different things that people might do or might try. So short version is a lot. I would play it, you know, doing next to nothing, just to see how that feels. And then I would play through it very, very aggressively, like a speed runner, and just look for ways to kind of break the experience both ways, and then make sure that the music is built to withstand that, or to accommodate that, actually is a better way to put it. You are just incredibly slow and want to find every little secret, and you're just
basking in the atmosphere of it. I don't want the game to beat you over the head with a bunch of kind of overstimulating, overly linear guidance. So if you're just really committed to staying in that area, you won't be subjected to the classic video gamey, just endless piles of boring loops. But instead, the music will kind of organically deconstruct itself and leave you with something kind of more minimal in its wake.
We haven't talked, well, we've talked a little bit about the main theme itself and how it formed actually really quickly. So then was it kind of a happy accident that the theme has this quality where I feel like you can only play a handful of notes from it here and there throughout the soundtrack. You don't need to hear the full melody. You just have these ghostly gestures, but then your mind fills it in.
If I'm writing a melody for a film or a game, or even if it was a concert piece or an opera or whatever, you name it, if it's supposed to serve a structural function, which to me is what theme implies, that's the fundamental difference between just any old melody and a theme. It serves a structural function to help the player track a sense of progression so that you actually feel things changing. So much of it, of that melody, you know, sometimes I'll write a melody and then I take a step back and I look at it and I say, how many different ways can I twist and turn this tune to suit all the different needs that I have for it? And so it becomes kind of this retroactive analysis process such that, in a game like Journey, every single note that you hear is a derivative of that theme. There are no other themes. And that's very much by design. And so even something like, you know, like you mentioned, it's wonderful that it comes across that you're able to kind of detect that there's so many times I'm kind of alluding to it more than directly stating it. And it's supposed to be something that you can kind of feel and fill in the gaps subconsciously. That's great. I mean, that's sort of my fantasy for what would happen. And sometimes it's not easy to pull that off. You know, in this case, the biggest strength, I think, of Journey's theme is that it's just such an incredibly simple melody. You know, I sometimes write melodies that are a lot more unpredictable. And so this one is kind of an anomaly, I guess, in that way. So yeah, just those little, just like even just, you know, the way it starts, I don't know if you can hear this, if you can hear that piano. The way it starts, you know, it just has this down a whole step, back up a whole step. So just that gesture alone is all through the score as a way to harken back to the theme. So there will be times where all I'm doing is, you know, because, you know, at any moment it could go where it's just teeing up that melody, you know. So having a very simple little gesture, or even like in the case of the Road of Trials, it's the same thing, you know, that same, it's in a different key, but it's that same, you know, so that I can, like, that's the theme. It's just got a lot of notes added in between all the other notes. But that was the practice throughout. I mean, that to me is also just, that's just kind of thematic development 101. I'm not inventing any technique at all there. That's the same kind of thing that opera composers have been doing for hundreds of years, and people like John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, you know, were doing all through the 20th century in film, you know, plenty of games have done that as well. And so that, just to me, it's just what Journey cried out for, basically.
Yeah, and I've heard back a lot from listeners of my previous podcasts about how they actually learned a lot from my stuff. So I do like to look at the technicalities of the music itself. So I wanted to look a little bit about Apotheosis and your use of counterpoint in it. And
sure.
I wondered if you could talk about the use of counterpoint and then why it matters to that track.
Well, so it's funny because Apotheosis was by far the most difficult thing to write in the score, because figuring out the exact tone and the exact pacing of the ending was something that dogged all of us. The gameplay itself was was not right for the longest time. It was too slow. It was too fast. It was boring. It was too complicated. It was not emotionally cathartic and sort of revelatory. You name it. We hated it for one reason or another all the time. And the score was in the same exact boat. I was constantly struggling and tried things that were very, very minimalist and kind of surreal, to the point of cerebral. The idea that we were very non-specifically in almost like the afterlife, and everything was supposed to have a very kind of hazy quality to it. And then saying, well, that doesn't work. You know, maybe it should be the opposite. Maybe it should be like this fantastical celebration. And so then I put something in that was almost like a turbocharged version of Road of Trials. And that just felt like we were rushing the player to say, okay, yeah, let's, you know, we got to be out of here by 5. So let's finish up this damn game. And then it's just like, that was totally wrong also. And so back and forth and back and forth. And then one day I just went into my studio and I played the game, and then I turned everything off, and I went over to the piano, and I just started thinking about something that had more of a kind of a gentle gallop. And I started playing around with, you know, that simple little figure that starts it off with the, you know, just this, there was something about that didn't feel rushed. You know, it's not harmonically moving a lot. You know, again, I know it's a little bit hard to hear, but, you know, it's a single static musical world. You know, if I'm going, you know, it's all very uniform. As opposed to, imagine if it was like this, you know. Notice how much faster that feels, and feels so much more aggressive. And so it's one of those things that you can have a lot of notes and yet it still feels pretty relaxed and feels chill. And so that was the balance that took a lot of iterations to kind of zero in on, is how much energy versus how much activity, because those are really not the same thing. And I liked it having a lot of activity, which is what the counterpoint can provide. But it couldn't have too much energy, because then it felt like we were rushing players through, and we were saying something that we weren't actually trying to say. And so finally landed on that. And then the other thing, a lot of people don't realize, that it's also just transparently the theme. But the theme is going by at like 1/3 the normal speed. So you have all this, you know, adding activity. And then you have the violas and the cellos below that going, you know, bum, 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 bum. Like, it's the theme. Da, na, 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 na. But just really slowly. And so that, it, you know, you can really build and build and build and build. And the phrases and the gestures take, you know, 20 and 30 seconds each, as opposed to 5 or 6 seconds to just go, bah, 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 you know, that, because that wouldn't have worked. That would have felt, again, too fast, too energetic. And so, you know, it's really easy to say all this now as if it was just so plain and obvious, but it was an eternal struggle, seemingly.
I can imagine. And as a player, it does come across like just... it's one of the most emotional moments I've ever had as a gamer, which I'm sure you've heard a lot. So something like that doesn't come overnight.
No, truly for any of us, particularly because at the very end, our playtesting seemed to vindicate that the game up until the end, like, you know, spoilers, but up until the kind of moment of collapse on the mountain, our playtesting was indicating that we had really dialed that in and everything was working really well. And then the scores and the relative enthusiasm from players would just calamitously fall off a cliff the moment they started the last level. So it was clear that we had something, we had 7/8 of a good thing. And so it made it this, and you know, all the more of an exaggerated struggle to truly stick the landing on the last part, because we were very aware of the stakes. It wasn't like, ah, well, you know, who knows if this thing is any good. It was like, no, we really do think we have something that's potentially pretty good. And we're kind of ruining it in the very 11th hour. And so, yeah, it was so stressful.
Oh, I can imagine. But as the response has shown, it must be worth it to see these thousands, probably millions of gamers have that response to it.
You know, it's as surreal to me today, 7 years later, as it was then. You know, everything that happened with Journey between the player, just the sheer number of, you know, sales and enthusiasm for it, to the incredibly personal nature of people's feedback and the kind of letters that we would get and tweets that I get of, you know, people don't say things like, oh man, that was really fun, or wow, that was really exciting. Well, to be clear, there are people that say that, and that would be wonderful enough. But then the fact that some people say things like, you know, this really helped me get through a really hard time, or even students saying, you know, I would have never finished my term paper if not for this game. Just the idea of kind of being useful to people and figuring into their lives in a positive way. I never had any inkling that would even be possible. When it shipped and we were waiting for the review embargo to lift, I remember thinking to myself, well, I don't have any clue if anyone is going to like this, but I do feel confident that we made what we wanted to make. It just remains to be seen if anybody other than us actually cares about that. But it was a rare moment of thinking, well, the reviews are just going to be whatever they're going to be. Because I feel like I wouldn't do anything differently at this point. Now, of course, in hindsight, there's lots of things that I would be thrilled to have a chance to sort of improve or correct, just little technical musical things and, you know, little glitches. And like when we do the show of the whole game, Journey Live, I invariably find little things that nag at me that I say, oh, I wish I could have another crack at that moment. But broadly speaking, I actually am proud of it in a way that I almost never am.
Well, that's good to hear, because you certainly should be. But just two last things, well, three actually, we'll try and get through quickly, is if you could discuss the use of electronic textures a little bit, because it is something that, as you said, a lot of people might not even realize is there.
Yeah, it's funny. I think because with Journey, people tend to be very fixated on the ending. People tend to talk most about the last few areas of the game. And because the score of those is pretty orchestral or pretty dominated by the interplay between the solo cello and the strings and the winds, it creates the impression that all of Journey must be. You know, if you only remember one thing and you remember it as being orchestral, the brain will just kind of automatically assume all of it was. But not only was that not what I thought to be the right thing, we couldn't have afforded that anyway. I remember it was one of those challenges where Sony made clear, we only can record, you know, X number of minutes of orchestra before we're over budget. So find a way to only need X. And so I said, well, what if the orchestra is kind of an emergent quality throughout the game, where as you get closer to, you know, in a sense, your destiny, the orchestra is expressing itself more and more and more and more. And it's much more subtle and much more powered by these soloists like the flute and the viola and the cello and the harp up to that point. So the first time you ever hear the orchestra, technically the first time you hear them is in the opening sort of cutscene where the sort of shooting star, as it were, is crossing the landscape and culminates in the player standing up and you take control. Technically there is orchestra kind of hidden in that chaos of sound, but the first time you hear it sort of exposed for just a second is when the little meteor crashes right in front of you in the open desert and you have a chance to interact with it and you know, grow your scarf and all that. And that's the first little glimpse. And then it comes in just little moments like that where the bigger picture is being alluded to. And I want to make it sense, you know, hints that there's kind of a bigger story going on than just this moment-to-moment traversal through the desert. And then the real moment where the orchestra finally steps forward is, you know, when you're in the kind of giant vertical tomb and you're constantly raising the level of the kind of magic water and ascending as you do, the orchestra starts to really become part of the game at that point. because you're sort of, you're at the source, you know, you're at, you've every time the player sings, you emit this little glyph out of yourself, a kind of name, as it were. And here you are in a space where there's tens of thousands of those lining the walls. So to me, it always felt like I was in a tomb or a crypt. And so I thought, you know, now we're getting into the real primal guts of this thing. And so the orchestra starts to really step forward, and you really hear it at that cutscene that where the camera sort of revolves in a circle around the player, and we reveal, you know, kind of that the player is on a well-trod path, that there's this kind of ancestor figure that is saying, you know, we knew all this would happen. You know, you're not the first to do this. And by the way, here's what's waiting for you. And we see that glimpse of struggle. And it was like, okay, now let's let the orchestra really speak. In fact, I remember what you have in there was basically my first draft of the cue. And then they did a mock-up of the scene. And Genova said, it feels so emotionally limp. He said, the scene really does not deliver what the music is promising. And I said, oh, well, I don't want to be distracting. Let me pare back the music and try to make it a little bit more subtle and understated. And he said, no. I think it's our responsibility to make the scene match the music and to rise to the level of the drama that you are creating. So they redid the whole scene. Originally, it was just kind of a series of shots. And then he said, you know, what if it's this, it might've even been Matt's idea, Matt Nava, to make it this big rotating camera, very kind of grand amphitheater sort of moment instead. And that seemed to be what helped it rise to the level of the drama of the music. That was one of those funny moments, because I was like, it's not all about the score by any means. I'm happy to walk it back. And they insisted on the other. So from that moment forward, the orchestra is pretty dominant in the soundscape. So yeah, the electronics have to do a lot of work prior to that. They have to really bridge the gaps. And I created a ton of sounds. There's a lot of just simple drones and things, but I would also take, you know, the cello or the flute and stretch the recordings out and make, you know, new long sounds. And I remember I was sharing a studio with the composer John Debney, who was working on the movie Predator with Predators, I think is what it was, the Robert Rodriguez Predator movie. And there was a lot of kind of jungle percussion and stuff that he was recording in his studio upstairs. And the percussionist had this big crate of all of his weird instruments and noisemakers that he left right outside my door. So I remember I would grab, you know, these odd things and record them and create textures and weird sounds for Journey that way, particularly for the opening of the game, you know, the whole initial awakening in the desert and the sort of graveyard where the texture is all that there is. Basically, and I recorded my own voice and all kinds of things like that, just to flesh it out and create layer after layer after layer, so it just becomes this kind of soup with no particularly identifiable constituent part. And that carries us through all the way through the whole game, basically.
Yeah, and to hear you speak about the atmospheres like that and how much it takes control at the beginning, my second to last question about Journey was actually about how closely you worked with Steve Johnson and how that took form.
Well, Steve was an incredible and brilliant collaborator. You know, his primary task was the sound design. And so, you know, while he was working on a lot of the traditional kind of Foley, like, I know he did an enormous amount of fine tuning to get the sand footsteps to sound right. Because Genova made clear, you know, we're going to hear a lot of footsteps through sand, and it has to feel gratifying. It has to feel like something sort of tasty and delicious that we enjoy, as opposed to something that feels like this labor intensive, exhausting thing that we probably typically associate with walking through the sand. And so he spent a lot of time on that. But then there was, as you're kind of alluding to, there was a lot of overlap. Obviously, the most obvious example is the players' sounds, you know, the singing or the chirping that you do. That was one of those where he and I really co-authored those sounds, where I created, you know, a batch of sounds that would change based on your progression through the game, so that it was always compatible with the score, which is obviously a trick I learned on Flow. And so I would create these sounds that are a hybrid of everything that's going on in the score at that moment. So I would have a little bit of cello, have a little bit of flute, have some electronics. And then I also recorded a human voice so that when the singer comes in for I Was Born for This, you've actually been hearing her voice all through the game every time you chirped. But you don't really hear her directly until the very end. And you can really overtly hear the voice during the apotheosis sequence. If you do your chirps, especially the really big ones, the charged up ones, you can hear Lisbeth's voice pretty obviously, so that by the time I Was Born for This comes in, there's a little bit of a kind of teaser that has been placed in your ear without you knowing it. And so I would send all of that to Steve, you know, and there were hundreds and hundreds of these, all organized by area of the game. And then he would manipulate them and do further kind of adjusting and remixing and mastering, and then also add in, you know, sounds like birds and animals, to really try to create a unique sound, or whistles. But then we would also collaborate in a million other areas. You know, for example, there's a moment in the on the mountain where you're having to face off against the wind, and there's these strong surges where you have to hide behind these kind of gravestones in order to not get blown back. And Matt or whomever designed those graves put little holes in the top. So I remember Steve saying, I'm going to get a big old glass Coke bottle and blow over the top in order to create a kind of whistle stone effect. And he called me and said, what key is the music in here? Because I'd love to be compatible with what you're doing. He was like, oh, well, kind of loosely in E minor there. And so those whistle stones are all this, you know, low E natural. That's an example. There were a million moments like that where we would kind of touch base with each other and say, you know, what are you doing for this? What are you doing for that? Let's try to make sure our work is always in sync with each other.
And that always makes a game stronger in the end. And it's really cool to hear that about Lisbeth's voice, because that was going to be my last question, is that we can't go that in-depth into Journey and not talk about I Was Born for This. And I wonder if you could talk about the decision behind the five different languages and the lyrics and how those lyrics were written. I mean, I know a lot of it's taken from old poetry. Just the general story behind that track.
Well, I was very... I mean, I'm a little old school, and I tend to love it when, you know, if you try to wrap up a story with some sort of a song, there's something about the song form, hearing a singer or singers or somebody, you know, kind of tell you a story that encapsulates and re-summarizes the whole thing. I mean, this is why movies do this so often in TV shows, because there's something so cathartic about it, and I don't even know if I fully understand why this is. But I was just so drawn to the idea. I was so moved by the game that I thought, you know, doesn't it seem like we need some kind of song to really bring it home? You know, like growing up, I always loved so much The Best Is Yet to Come from Metal Gear Solid and other games that have done that. Never mind, you know, countless movies and things where I just thought, I want to have a stab at that kind of gesture. But it couldn't just be some song. And also... part of the challenge was specifically, what is she singing? And like you already mentioned, it's a lot of classic poetry and literature. And I thought, you know, if she just starts singing, you know, in English or in Italian or Latin or Japanese, or it's going to create this bizarre idea that, you know, that's sort of the secret of the game. And the whole point of the game was its universality, and it's the fact that these archetypes from mythology are shared by every culture in the world. So I started thinking, well, I think we need a kind of pan-cultural approach to this piece. And I have a composer friend who I've known since we were in our undergrad together, named Jeremy Beck, who is a spectacular composer, but he's also a real study of the poetic literature. I mean, he even studied creative writing and things like that in college, and his knowledge of the sort of literary repertoire is rather enormous. So I went to him and I said, you know, here's kind of what I am thinking, and I would love your help pointing me in the right direction. I mean, I knew obvious pieces like the Iliad or Beowulf, you know, stories that deal with the hero's journey in their own way. But he got me thinking, and that's how we ended up landing at, you know, the Basho haiku or
or even just the words, say, for Selah, of the final words before her death and execution of Joan of Arc, you know, do not grieve for me, for I was born for this. That, you know, finding those, it was a long process, and shuffling them around, you know, it's starting at one point with the Greek and then realizing, no, that doesn't quite work, because we're just trying with the Latin and moving it and trying to create an emotional progression based around the kind of the literal taste of those languages. It wasn't easy. And it was the very, very last thing. I put it off at the very end. I'll never forget our producer, Robin Hunneke, who, you know, we had become such dear friends, but she was always, one of her strengths as a producer, she was always quite real with me. And she said, look, I think the idea of a song sounds really stupid. It sounds really cheesy, like you're trying to do some bad anime thing. And I said, just trust me, you know, you can reject it and I'll do something different, but let me give it to you so you can hear it and then judge that, as opposed to feedback based purely on the pitch. And so I remember I went and did a computer mock-up, and I had no idea of the lyrics yet. So I just had a singer come in and basically just sort of give me an ooh or an ah, just kind of no, 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 you know, and sent that scratch, and everybody just, you know, said, okay, well, you know, how soon can you have the lyrics? So yeah, it was a truly wonderful, got very lucky, especially because both Apotheosis and I Was Born for This get programmed by orchestras for performance all the time now. And that's pretty rare, that, you know, you get something that can kind of be extracted essentially verbatim how you originally wrote it without a lot of adaptation for the stage. And I've just been very, very lucky that those pieces somehow landed in that spot and that people actually noticed them and then have gone to that effort to actually put them up on stage.
I had a whole set of questions about Abzu, but in order to not like take up a whole hour of your time, I wondered if you could just talk in general about how different your approach might have been to Abzu and some of the things you might have had in mind for this project instead.
Well, you know, it's one of those that it's hard to give you an answer, because every project I start with the question of how can I make something that feels like this project and this project only. You know, I don't want to do something that feels like, oh, here he is at it again, and it's very derivative of that which you already know. The goal is to make something that feels like it's kind of born organically of that thing, and that's all that it is. And so Abzu, you know, had this diametrically opposed starting position from Journey, whereas Journey is all about the kind of beautiful desolation. Abzu is, you know, you're immersed in this kind of explosion of bountiful life, and that creates an incredibly different experience right out of the gate. And so even if there are some beats in common and some kind of fundamental structural DNA they share, the aesthetic is as opposite as anything you could do. And so the score, you know, had to reflect that, I felt.
The one thing that really stuck out to me about Abzu instead of Journey is that Journey had this one theme that everything was built towards, whereas Abzu instead, like you said, seemed to have so much more life to it, and it had so much more raised throughout the game that all seemed to build towards that waters mingle together, where it does literally seem to come together musically. And I wondered if I'm any kind of right about that.
Yeah, you absolutely are. I thought, as a almost just as a creative exercise, I asked myself, what if I, because there's a justification for Abzu similarly being very monothematic. And actually, I would argue it is, because I differentiate between a theme and just an incidental melody. Whereas Journey sort of pathologically avoids even incidental melodies and really tries to keep everything very rigorously built around the theme somehow, Abzu has a theme that kind of follows the story of the diver, but every region of the game is kind of like a little musical island unto itself, where I try to develop a musical identity that lives, grows, and then we move past, and then a new one is introduced. So it's kind of like there's a single theme that's traveling through a bunch of very diverse landscapes. That was the idea. And I would say, honestly, the biggest inspiration for that was, you take a classical ballet like The Rite of Spring, where he creates little vignettes. It's like 10 minutes or, you know, 5-6 minutes, whatever, of kicking around a little motif or a little idea. And then once he's kind of said everything he needs to say with it, he basically puts it down and never comes back to it. The whole thing is completely through composed with no reflection later of material that you've heard. He leaves it in the past. So I said, is there a way to combine that approach with something that actually does have a central theme or motif that you can hear, so that, you know, the little oboe, you know, da, na, 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 that is a little melody that you know, transcends the whole game, but then every area has its little proprietary signature. And I tried to make those really distinct from one another. I sometimes wonder how much I actually succeeded at that, but that was that. What you're saying was explicitly the goal.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that I wasn't off in La La Land with that one then. That's good to hear. So in that case, we will jump into Banner Saga then, try and get through some of this in 20 minutes, because there's so much to talk about here. The soundtrack blows my mind. The first thing I thought I'd ask about is the authenticity of it, because unlike Journey and Abzu and Flow, there are some very real human inspirations here, the Norse mythology and the Scandinavian stuff. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that authenticity, because I also spoke to Gareth Coker about his Norse mythology for Minecraft, and he was speaking about how straight up authenticity might not necessarily work for a modern video game, especially something like Minecraft. But what struck me about this is just how authentic it was. And I wondered if you could talk about some of the study you might have done for that, or how you've actually
got
that
across. I think Gareth is right, first off, that sometimes the spirit of something is closer to what you want than a literal reproduction of it. That's not uncommon at all, but particularly with ancient folk traditions. But in this case also, add to that Norse traditions, and particularly the Vikings, are largely unknown. We don't even really know what real Viking music sounds like. I did look into it when I started on the Banner Saga, but mostly out of curiosity, because it was never the goal for it to feel sort of anthropologically accurate, for the most obvious reason that the game is loosely inspired by those things, but it's very much not those things. You know, you compare the Banner Saga, it's all original characters and mythology. It's the tone of it and the kind of hallmarks of it are Norse inspired. But in contrast to a game like, say, God of War, there's no references to Thor and Wotan and any of these other, you know, archetypal figures. It is very much only the kind of spirit of it, or the flavor of it. And that was the case with the music. I wanted it to feel mostly reflective of the kind of situation of the characters, which was very, very desperate situation, very alone, very dire, and also very exhausted. That was one of the things that I was especially fixated on, is that these are very big, burly, badass, powerful warriors, and the only thing that they want is essentially to just fall asleep, because the storyline of the game revolves around this sort of supernatural freezing of the sun in the sky. And so I talked with the developers, Stoic, particularly the writer Alex Thomas, and said, you know, we kind of dug into that, and I said, it would seem to me that if you're in perpetual daylight, you know, it's like that Christopher Nolan movie Insomnia, where you're going to start to lose your mind. And that these characters, every time they pick up their axe or they pick up their sword, they do so with this heavy sigh of like, my God, really? Again? That was sort of the jumping off point, more than the, you know, historical perspectives or something like that. I mean, I didn't want to be ignorant of those, but it actually really wasn't the sort of driving force.
Well, I think that one thing that stuck it out and made it feel particularly authentic to me was its use of scales and its actual musical movement, in that you might hear some Norse mythology stuff that really is just following like an E minor or something, but I was really interested in some of the scales that you were using, because I've never really heard that kind of melodic movement before.
I think mainly I just made things kind of weird and unpredictable. You know, one of the ways that you can kind of learn about what music might have sounded like from a given culture, where there are no, you know, written transcriptions or sheet music left, is to just look at the construction of an instrument and see what would have sounded natural on this, because that tends to be what they do. They're not going to play something super inorganic to the instrument. The instrument design is going to chase what they were playing. And so I had this one musician I work with a lot, Noah Gladstone. He commissioned the custom construction of a thing called a buka horn, which is basically a hollowed out ram's horn that they then drill finger holes into. And he
brought it over, and it was like, this thing can only really play like six notes, and of those, you know, these few sound the best. And so you start to immediately make assumptions about, well, if this was an authentic Viking instrument, then it's going to start to revolve around these very specific pitches and these very specific movements between them. And, you know, with that as my leaping off, I just kind of went from there, and the rest just sort of organically followed. And then between the fact that, you know, it's just sort of my practice as a composer anyway, but also given that I had to do three games, three scores in the trilogy, at some point it just starts developing itself, and it's no longer about that kind of touchstone of Viking sound or the Norse sound or the Scandinavian landscape or any of that sort of stuff. And it just starts to become, you know, I would write, like, especially I remember starting on Banner Saga 2, I started writing and I would just ask myself, does this sound like the Banner Saga? And by that point, the vocabulary had started to sort of settle into a place where I would be able to say, yeah, actually, you know what? This does sound like the Banner Saga, and that doesn't. And then as new characters entered into the story, finding ways to expand what that means while being authentic to it and all of that. It was an ongoing process, and honestly, it was one of the most wonderful I've ever had. If they called me tomorrow and said, we've greenlit 10 more Banner Saga games, I'd be over the moon, because it's just hands down one of the best experiences I've ever had. I grew so much. It was so creatively like having this incredible physical trainer that just pushed me to the brink of what I was capable of. And I'm so grateful for that. And I love those characters, and I love the art style. You know, Arnie Jorgensen's just incredibly beautiful Ivan Durrell-esque aesthetic. And it's just every detail of it to me is just, it's just a dream. And I never thought, I shouldn't say never. I was prepared to never feel that way again after Journey. I thought, you know, I'm probably ruined now, and I'm just so spoiled by such a special experience that nothing will ever excite me like this. And then it was like, a day after Journey ships, I get a call from Stoic, who are running their Kickstarter for the Banner Saga, and said, take a look at this. And it's just instantly in love again.
And it truly is outstanding. But you were talking about the actual sound of the Banner Saga and what sounds like Banner Saga. And I know that this might be a bit of a reductive question, but it's good for the purposes of the podcast. If you could talk about that musical palette and how you came to those decisions for this game, and why you stuck with them.
You know, it's one of those that it's hard for me to define over, you know, technically. A big part of it is the sound. There's something very, you know, strings. First off, strings are the most monochromatic orchestral color, meaning between the bass up to the, you know, the lowest note, the open E or C string on a bass at the very bottom of the sound, all the way up to the highest, most shrill harmonic of a violin. You have the entire range of music, basically, sonically covered by strings, and in a very smooth and a homogeneous way. So violins very organically give way to violas, which organically give way to cellos and then to basses. And you can create a big full chord or harmony or whatever that spans the entire hearing range of humans, and it's one color. In the same way that you can play a big wide chord on the piano and it's all piano, strings are homogeneous, and they're the only family that's sort of broadly true of, because brass, you know, trumpets are really different sounding from tuba. It's not just that they're the high pitched version of the same thing. They are fundamentally different sounds. And that's even more true with woodwinds. And so I'll add to that, strings are bowed. You know, you play them with your hands. You don't have to use your lungs to play them. And so they can sustain sound infinitely, theoretically, whereas winds and brass are limited by the sound of your by your literal physical lung capacity. And so I have always found that there's an intrinsic awareness with brass and winds, even among the totally musically uninitiated,
that there's an exertion that goes into playing winds and brass that you don't associate with strings. Strings are so capable of being ethereal and magical, and part of the reason why is that you don't, it's easy to not really feel the presence of the human playing it, in the same way that, you know, especially on good recordings of brass and winds, you literally hear them take a big inhale but before a long phrase, and then when the note finally stops ringing, you could often hear them gasp to get air back into their lungs. And so I found myself just thinking, you know, this game is all about the kind of exhaustion of these players and of these characters. I mean, and what if the orchestra kind of mirrored that and we completely did away with the strings? And there's a lot of reasons for this also. Strings have a tendency to warm up the sound. And even though brass and winds are capable of being very warm and beautiful, they're also capable of being very stark and cold. And so I thought, you know, big, long chords held by strings and winds, I'm sorry, by brass and winds, rather, has a very different and very kind of cold and even eerie quality compared to the exact same notes very warmly being held by strings. And then the other aspect of it is that the brass and the winds and the percussion, that's all the loud members of the orchestra. So I thought, I want this score to feel very heavy, you know, like in that same manner of their exhaustion. It should feel very weighted physically. And so if you get rid of the strings, but then you add back in a bunch more brass, winds, and percussion, so whereas a normal orchestra would have like four French horns because they're plenty loud to be heard with only four of them against, say, 24 violins or 12 violas or 8 or 10 cellos, four horns will cut it in a, you know, in an 80-piece orchestra. And I said, well, what if we cut out all the strings, but then it's, you know, it's 9 horns, and instead of 3 trombones, it's 6 trombones, and instead of 1 tuba, it's 2 tubas, and instead of 1 timpani, it's 2 timpani, and instead of 2 flutes, it's 5 flutes, and all that. So we built the orchestra back up to, you know, 60, 70 people, but with no strings anywhere. And so as a result, they could play very quietly, but it would feel incredibly heavy. It would feel like, my God, tectonic plates are shifting. And that was very attractive to me, that because I didn't, ironically, because Banner Saga 2 and 3 are probably the most cacophonously aggressive scores I've ever written, the idea was actually to avoid that initially. I thought, I want this to feel like the weight of the world, should not feel like the apocalypse and that hellfire is raining down on you. It should feel like extremely heavy, quiet, you know, resignation. And nothing seemed to quite nail that for me with this, other than the kind of wind ensemble sound. And that led to all kinds of fun, specific shenanigans about, like, well, where should I even record this? What musicians should I use? And we ended up recording it in Texas with a professional wind ensemble, and they had never done a recording session before. And their performance hall, the Meyerson Symphony Center, where they and the Dallas Symphony both perform, you know, was not equipped for recording sessions. So I had to fly my whole crew from Los Angeles to Dallas in 1,000-degree summer heat with maximum humidity, and it was a crazy adventure that I wasn't anticipating, but just an absolutely joyous one.
And what was it like to work with the Dallas Wind Symphony then? Because it sounds like if it was their first time recording that, they really stepped up to the game.
Well, I mean, they were very, very well-respected musicians as an orchestra, so it wasn't like their lack of experience recording a score meant that I was remotely questioning the caliber of performance I would get. It was all just, can I integrate from a technical way with their facility? But I never had any doubts as to what they were musically capable of. But that said, they were so enthusiastic about the chance to do something this novel and this unusual from their normal that the vibe in the room was just spectacular. I mean, everyone was having so much fun.
That's great to hear. And it's funny because it is quite a gloomy, dark, looming soundtrack. But now you mention it, I can actually hear behind that the players themselves, the challenge and the inspiration behind that playing. Yeah, I could definitely hear it.
I got very lucky. I mean, they were really, really
excited to do it, and they were incredible partners. And it took a lot of planning and coordination. I mean, it was not a it was not an easy thing to set up, but it was so worth it.
Well, if I could just fit in three more questions about this, I don't know if I've got time for that.
Sure, go for it.
So you haven't talked too much about the use of vocals. I wondered if you could talk about bringing them into the soundtrack and the singers involved.
Yeah, that started, funny enough, because of the nature of the Kickstarter that they did. Because they were, you know, they called me when they still had 2 weeks left to go on their fundraising. And they were already, you know, 300% of the goal. And so they were saying, you know, how can we really capitalize on this momentum? And so they told me, you know, there's one of the really high priced items on their Kickstarter was that you could basically be a character in the game. That they would model the drawings and animation after you. If you gave them like $1,000 or something pretty substantial, you could be added to the game, to the lore and everything. And the specific way that they were doing it was within the storyline of the game, the pantheon of gods are not only real, but they are knowingly and definitely dead. In other words, the gods kind of got into a big civil war at some point in the history of the world, and they legitimately killed themselves off. So it's not a folklore like, you know, I hear the gods are gone. It is a plainly known fact to the people of this world. And the reason for that being important is that as the apocalypse starts, there is no chance for a kind of Deus Ex Machina. There will be no help from above because up above is empty. And so that was a very important part of the story and the premise of the game. And so in tandem with that, the world is dotted in its landscape with these huge like grave markers, basically, for the gods that are dead and gone. And so for the Kickstarter thing, it was like, you can be one of the godstones. And so send us your photo and Arnie will make a kind of godstone-ized version of you. And you can even write the lore so that when your characters pass by it, you can inspect it. And then the sort of bard in the group will say, ah, that's the god, you know, Dengler, who this, that, and this, that. And you can actually contribute to that writing just as a way to integrate with the community and embrace the whole Kickstarter nature of it. And I thought that was just the coolest thing. So I said, you know, what if every time your caravan passes one of these things, it's a tradition within the characters of the world to sing in honor of the god. So then I went to the Kickstarter backers and I said, I want you to tell me about this god so that I can develop lyrics inspired by your character. And then the idea would be that the caravan is singing in Icelandic as you pass by. And so that became this thing we were all very excited about, and it was a lot of fun. And so then, of course, if you start talking about singing, you can't avoid the question of, well, who's going to be the singer? And since the whole thing was born of the internet, you know, the Kickstarter is the only reason why the Banner Saga exists. And Kickstarter is such a beautiful manifestation of the power of the internet. Crowdsourcing funding, to me, is one of the most beautiful ways that you can show the interconnectivity that the internet has to offer. And so I thought, well, what if the hiring of the singers follows a similar mentality or philosophy? And so I basically just said, well, who are interesting YouTubers who are making their living as musicians because of the power of the internet? And there was like this perfect storm where at that same time, incidentally, across my desk comes Peter Holland's cover of the Misty Mountains, you know, dwarven song from The Hobbit. And I hear this man singing this kind of gravelly dwarvish thing. And it was so beautiful. And I just immediately reached out to him and said, I need you for this thing I'm doing. And then similarly, around that same time, a singer in Mexico named Maluka did a cover of a bard song from Skyrim that was just hauntingly beautiful. And I called her up. In fact, the Kickstarter community said, like it was on the message board of, has anybody seen this incredible Maluka Skyrim thing? And, you know, her video was going super viral, you know, practically in that moment, and reached out to her and said, I need you to be part of this thing. And then, and they were both, thrilled to jump in. And then for the violin, the one and only string instrument in the score, which, you know, the reason for that dealt with the story of the father-daughter dynamic between the characters of Rook and Alette. I wanted to break my kind of no strings rule with a one lone violin. And around that time, this violinist, Taylor Davis, did a cover of Journey with this incredible music video where she's in cosplay and she's in the snow and on sand dunes. And so I just called her up and said, you are incredible. This is by far the best cover anybody has done of Journey. And I'd be honored to work with you on the Banner Saga. And so, so that was how we found my little trio, and we stuck together for all three games. And, we added another group on Banner Saga 2 called Arstíðr, which was the same thing. It was a band from Iceland that had a video go viral on YouTube of them singing, an Icelandic hymn in a, subway station. And these five guys singing, like, you know, this music that was this perfect intersection of very masculine and macho and very delicate and beautiful. And I just thought that is the Banner Saga. So I reached out to them, and they had never worked on a video game before. They weren't even gamers. They were like a rock band. And but they said, sure, why not? And that was especially nice because they are actually Icelandic. So poor Peter and Maluka had to suffer learning how to pronounce Icelandic, which is incredibly difficult. Whereas with these guys, it was easy. So that was a nice little bonus. And then the third singer, the third soloist to join in was Ivor on Banner Saga 3. She's from the Faroe Islands, which is right off the coast of Iceland, basically, kind of halfway between Iceland and the UK. And I just came across a video of her singing on YouTube. And she's a lot more established of like a solo artist and does music that, you know, is very kind of authentically Faroese and Icelandic and Nordic, but then also stuff that's almost like straight pop music. And she also does like grand cinematic epic stuff. And she's a composer. She was working on a TV show. And so I just cold called her and got on the phone with her management and said, you know, I'd love to write a kind of finale end credit song for the Banner Saga 3 to round out this trilogy. And I'd love for you to sing it. And the ironic thing is, I reached out and she was already about halfway through working with my friend, Bear McCreary, as a featured soloist on God of War. And so I was like, well, then I guess I definitely came to the right source. And she did a phenomenal job, as well. But yeah, Taylor plays the violin, and the, you know, nested within the grand end of the world story of the Banner Saga is this father-daughter, struggle. As they are, they're basically like simple kind of provincial farmers who are caught up in all this craziness. And spoiler, you know, at the end of the first game, you have to make a decision as a player that will end up killing one or the other. And so Banner Saga 2 and 3 are both kind of on, they're both two games in one, on parallel path, where depending on who survived at the end of Banner Saga 1, that becomes the central character then for the other games. And so it's either a daughter struggling to live up to the legacy of her father and learning to kind of be an adult sooner than she was expecting to have to be an adult, and to also be a leader of a bunch of people she doesn't know in a situation she doesn't understand. Or it's all of those things as a guy, as the father who's grappling with the meaninglessness of having lost his daughter, and the way it has left him feeling adrift in the world. And so there's this very, very intimate and emotionally powerful heart at the center of the kind of main player character. And I wanted there to be a unique instrument distinct from all the rest that we kind of associate with that. And the solo violin seemed to be the natural choice. And I remember I called Taylor, and she has a really nice violin that, you know, she paid a bit of
bit of extra cash for, and is kind of her main instrument. And I said, do you have a cheap, crappy one, like a violin that you would have practiced on as a kid that's just overtly not very high quality, and that you can play like a little out of tune and things like that? Because that's what I want. I want something rustic, like a folk instrument. And so she dug up an older violin that really wasn't very attractive and kind of put it a little bit out of tune and played with almost no vibrato and all that kind of thing. And that's sort of how we built that sound and then developed that over the course of all three games.
Right, that's really interesting to hear. I mean, it's a shame we haven't got more time because I love that technique stuff. I actually play a bit of cornet myself. I would have loved to hear a bit more about how you lent into those brass techniques.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's actually, the funny thing is that there's not a lot of unusual techniques. I do a lot of aleatory, so there's a lot of kind of free-for-all anarchic chattering throughout all three scores in a way that's almost classical modernism. But we don't do a lot in terms of sort of advanced techniques, depending on what you're asking. It's all about letting the brass just resonate through a big warm hall, because that sound is just unlike anything else. Brass can do just unbelievably huge amounts of stuff, and it's just really, really, it's really beautiful and exciting. And so yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those, we definitely could go on forever and ever about it, just because it's such, there's such a wonderful group, and I had such a wonderful time, you know, and each score ended up having little bits of difference in their execution. You know, for example, the Banner Saga 2 was recorded in Colorado with the Colorado Symphony, and then Banner Saga 3 was done in London with a session orchestra at Air Lyndhurst, and all of that kind of ended up affecting how things played out. And so it's all kind of an endless, it's like a fractal thing where there's just more stories at every turn, because it was 6 years of my life, you know, working on almost 2 hours of music for each game, and just, you know, pouring everything into it. I really can't overstate how much I love that franchise.
Yeah, I can hear that in the music and how much you were challenging yourself and feeling that inspiration. It's wonderful. And thank you for talking to me about it. I'm sorry it's gone so over long.
Oh, it's okay. You know, you came prepared with sort of real questions that let me dive into some of the minutiae that, frankly, honestly, I am not that often offered. It's been great.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Austin. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hopefully I'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. Right, speak again. Have a good day.
All right. Take care.
Bye for now.
Brother Yosef Magnus.